He was a pastor from Black Mountain, North Carolina, and he'd been the pastor of a small church in Turkey for 25 years. His name is Andrew Brunson. And he found himself standing before a Turkish court facing multiple charges, including espionage and terrorism. He faced a sentence of 35 years. He was 50 years old. He was the father of three. So basically, this was a life sentence, and he was being used as a political pawn. And he said, "My 2 years in prison were marked by what I call the silence of God. Not having any sense of his presence, I was the only Christian in prison. The only Christian I had contact with was my wife, so I was very alone. I was isolated in my faith. I prayed for peace so much, but I didn't feel much peace. Grace was taking me through, but finding strength and determination and peace and joy was more difficult than I expected. I didn't feel people praying for me. I had grace, but it was unfelt grace. My first year in prison, I broke repeatedly." Many Christians can relate. They've experienced times when they pray and God seems silent. Maybe it was during a time of betrayal, or maybe a time of divorce. Maybe it was a health challenge. Things never got better. Or people find themselves in a marriage where they're doing and sustaining everything and their spouse is missing in action and they don't seem to care. And maybe you've watched a loved one suffer and you pray and you pray, and they don't get any better. God doesn't seem to hear. Well, today, I'm starting a new series out of what I would call an unusual book of the Bible, the book of Esther. It's one of the two books in the Bible where God is never mentioned by name. Now, if you read through the Bible, all the way through, you will find God everywhere. He's on every page. He's in Genesis, in the creation of the world. He's in Egypt, setting the children of Israel free. He's in the Promised Land as a warrior. But in Esther, there are no direct references to God. Never once is prayer mentioned. Worship is never spoken of. And neither is Jerusalem. We're not even sure of the author. A Jewish historian, Josephus, says it was Mordecai. Whoever it was an eyewitness who knew the details of the temple. So as we get into this book, I do believe that you'll see God at work, though not in an obvious way. And sometimes that's the way God works in our lives. So I want to invite you to turn with me to Esther chapter 1. You might have to look in your concordance on this one, because this is not a book of the Bible that we look at very often. Esther chapter 1, and I'm going to start with the first three verses. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over the 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for his nobles and his officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, and the princes and nobles of the provinces were present. The setting of the book is the city of Susa, 5th century Persia. This is modern-day Iran. This was a huge empire. It controlled more than 2.9 million miles. It's estimated that 44% of the world's population lived in Persia, and it had some 50 million people. To give you an idea, if you were to walk from Atlanta to Los Angeles and back to Atlanta again, you would get an idea of the breadth of this empire. The book of Esther is one of the best historical sources for the history and life of the Persian Empire. So we're introduced, first of all, to King Xerxes. He was the king with a thirst for wine and a disregard for women. He could change his mind on a whim. He really wanted to defeat Greece where his father had failed. So he throws this lavish banquet to try to convince all of his nobles, his officials, his princes, his governors to support his new military campaign. He was 35 years old and he was rich beyond imagination. His palace was amazing. A century later, Alexander the Great would enter his palace at Susa, and he would find 270 tons of gold and bullion, worth, by today's standards, $54.5 billion. This was a wealthy king. So they were having this big drinking carnival, and it probably took 180 days to get all these people together and for this big feast, which would last for 7 days. And the queen was named Vashti. She gave a banquet for all the women. On the seventh day, when the king was really drunk, he got his eunuchs together. Now, whether these were castrated men or these high officials, we really don't, not sure, because Potiphar, you remember Potiphar from the Bible, he was called a eunuch, and he had a wife. So in any case, they were called together by the king. These were his key advisors, and he gave this command. He says in verse 11, "Bring before me Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles. She is lovely to look at." So look over here in verse 12 of chapter 1. We see what her response was. "But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. And then the king became furious and burned with anger." Well, the queen did not want to go to a drinking party to be shown off. And she refuses. And King Xerxes gets mad. And his counselors always agreed with him, so they tell him, "If you let her get away with this, all of our wives will start disobeying us, and it will become a national problem." Can you imagine the problem? You can see the problem. A nation of disobedient wives. Now, this is obviously a pagan, godless nation. But think about this now. There's always been problems between husbands and wives. So the king has to figure out what he's going to do with his disobedient queen. And his advisors are more than happy to help him out. And you know, I think today we are a country that's run by advisors, not by the actual politician. The politician, the advisors are telling many of our leaders what to say and what to do. So let's look at verse 19. And I'm going to read verse 22. "Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout the vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest." The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed, and he sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province, its own script, to its each people with their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household using his native tongue. So the problem is solved. A national decree, wives must obey their husbands. Everything's taken care of. But we also know that when a decree was issued, it could not be changed. So basically, the queen was demoted. She was no longer queen. In chapter 2, the king sobers up. He has a clear mind. He regrets what he did. And just think about this a moment. How many terrible decisions have been made when people were high or drinking? What we're seeing here. Well, the counselor knows if the king takes the queen back, they're going to be in big trouble. So they have another idea for the king. Let's have a Miss Persia contest. So look over here in chapter 2, starting in verse 2. "Then the king's personal attendants proposed, 'Let a search be made for the beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel in Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. History tells us that King Xerxes was a lusty king. He was basically a Hugh Hefner type king. And the king fails in his military campaign, so he comes back and he focuses on his harem, which basically, his whole process went on for 3.5-4 years. So Max Lucado has a good book, and I want to recommend it to you, on Esther, and it's called Made for This Moment. And I recommend it to you, but he does not talk about some things in the book of Esther, which I'm going to talk about. One of those things he talks about is harems. Now, we have a godless society here. This king would set apart women for himself. King Xerxes could do whatever he wanted. There was no system of checks and balances. It was a dictatorship. Josephus, Jewish historian, said there were some 400 women in his harem. Other sources say he had 360 concubines. He had one section for wives, one for concubines, and one for virgins. We really don't know how it all worked. But once you were a concubine of the king, you could never marry, and you could never have an ordinary life. This is how life was in godless Persia. So the search is made for a beautiful virgin that would be brought before the king. And there was one man, a eunuch, in charge of the whole process, Haggai, who basically oversaw everything. And for a whole year, the women would be selected, would be trained, and they would be taught how to act in the royal court. They were dressed up, they were given massages, they were given bath and beauty treatments. This was long before Ulta and all the cosmetics today, but even then they had all these things for the women. And it's during this time that we're introduced to two more of the main characters of the book of Esther. Esther 2:5 says there was a Jew named Mordecai of the tribe of Benjamin. It was probably one of his descendants who was taken in one of the deportations of the Jews by the Babylonians. So then we are introduced to Esther. So looking over here in chapter 2, in verse 7, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So Mordecai's cousin Hadassah was given the Persian name Esther. Her parents died, and Mordecai, who was much older, had taken her in as a daughter. Esther's described as a beautiful woman. It says right there in the scripture, she had a beautiful figure. That's not my words. That's what the Bible says. And all these beautiful virgins were taken to the palace, and Esther was taken too, and Mordecai, her adopted father, tells her, don't tell anyone that you are a Jew. So Esther did not tell anyone who she was. And she impressed everyone, especially Haggai, the attendant in charge. So she is put at the top of the list. He made sure she got all the beauty treatments, that she had the right number of attendants. And all this went on for 12 months. And Esther went through all the training and all the treatments. And finally, it's her turn to appear before King Xerxes. Esther 2:17 says, now the king was attracted to Esther more than any other women. So she won his approval more than any of the other virgins. And he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So we have a happy ending, right? Now, the king is not exactly monogamous here, but he favors Esther. And she's elevated to the highest position of honor for women in the kingdom of Persia. But as any story goes, trouble wasn't far away. In chapter 3, we're introduced to the villain, Haman. Now, Haman kind of sounds like Hangman. A good description. I found this picture. This is from one of the TV adaptions of Haman. I thought he kind of looked like a Haman to me. Anyway, Max Lucado describes him as a wealthy, influential officer in the cabinet of Xerxes. He had money, he got manicures, he played golf with the king, and he had the ear of the king. but he had the compassion of Hitler. King Xerxes elevated him, giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the nobles. So 5 years pass. Esther had been queen for 5 years. Life had been good to her and Mordecai. They're living in luxury. They're both keeping their nationality secret. As far as anyone knows, they are Persian. Esther's living in the palace, but she still kept in contact with her adopted father, Mordecai. In fact, he had overheard two men discussing an assassination attempt on the king. He lets Esther know. She tells the king. He investigates, finds out it's valid, and the men are killed, and so Mordecai is showing that he's helpful to the king. So we continue on in chapter 3, and we look in verses 2 through 6. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So all the king's officials were bowing before Haman except for one man. Guess who? Mordecai. So we always find him near the gate. He probably worked for the king at the gates and maybe oversaw them. The Bible doesn't give us the reason why he wouldn't bow, but it probably wasn't just the act of bowing, because he probably bowed to the king. But there was a reason why Mordecai wouldn't bow to Haman, and it was related to his faith. Might have been because of Haman's background. It's possible that Haman was an Amalekite, a nation that was a sworn enemy of the Jews. We just don't know exactly why. But Haman could not handle the fact that Mordecai would not bow to him. And Mordecai, for the first time, reveals that he was a Jew. And day after day, the royal officials came to Mordecai asking why he wouldn't bow down. But Mordecai refused to give in to the pressure to conform. And Haman is filled with such rage and such pride and arrogance. He felt threatened. He felt paranoid. And he decided to reap vengeance, not only on Mordecai, but his people. He wanted to kill all the Jews. So Haman starts using dice, probably superstition to consult pagan gods, to come up with a date to kill all the Jews. So after many attempts, finally he comes up with a date and a month when it will happen, and he makes a formal request to the king that all the Jews should be killed. And this is in verse 8 of chapter 3. Then Haman said to the king Xerxes, "There's a certain people among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please." So what reason does he give for killing, wanting to kill these people? One reason is he says these people, notice the word Jew is not even mentioned here. These people have different customs. Their laws are wrong. Like in our society today, if you're different, if you don't go along with the present administration, if you have a different view on things, you're wrong. That's the way it is today. Then Haman lies. They don't obey the king's laws. Now, this wasn't a problem with all the Jews. It was just Mordecai. So he takes one person and he says, every single Jew is like this. It sounds familiar. That's what happens today. You take one person, one race, and say everybody's like that. He says to the people, he says, this people shouldn't be tolerated in your kingdom. King, if you will issue a decree, they will be destroyed. And he says, I will pay you 10,000 talents of silver. My research says this would be about $20 million. I'll give you $20 million if you'll do this. Now, we're living proof today of the destructive things that people will say and do if you give them money. In politics, follow the money. Major decisions people make, follow the money. It's not surprising the king agrees to mass murder. It was all decided in a secret meeting. And so today, we have a lot of secret meetings going on. Babies are being killed. Human traffickers are being led into our country by people with power, and they're disconnected to the common person. People are, like us, the common people are being harmed by these decisions by people that aren't even connected to our daily life. So the decision is made 11 months before it's to happen, and the Jews are spread out all over Persia. Only a few had actually returned to Jerusalem, and there was a large Jewish community in the Babylonian capitals. Verse 13, this is very telling. Dispatches were sent by carriers to all the king's provinces in order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, to plunder and to plunder their goods. So letters were sent out to kill all the Jews. Total annihilation, and their possessions were to be taken. So how was Haman supposed to get all of his money? Maybe he was very wealthy. Was he going to pay the assassins? Like, if you kill all these people, you get to keep all their money. Was he going to take the money of the people that he killed? We really don't know. Verse 15. Then Haman sat down to drink. The king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was bewildered. Typical politicians, sitting around enjoying life, protected from danger, getting rich, while the world around them is in chaos because of the decisions that they're making. Now for the big question, where was God? And wouldn't it have been so much easier if Mordecai just would have bowed down? Sometimes obedience causes problems, it causes conflict, it causes hurt feelings. Haman's hatred was so deep. He had a whole race of people that he hated. Sounds kind of like Nazism. Sounds like Hitler. Mordecai and Esther were far from home. But trouble was brewing, and it would have been much easier just to go with the flow, not to tell anybody about their faith, just go along with it. But following God goes against the popular culture. In today's America, if you come out with the fact that you're a Christian, you could be ostracized and maybe even labeled as crazy or right-wing because of your faith. There's a very famous photo of a man, and this was taken in 1936 at a Nazi rally in Hamburg, Germany. You'll see him standing in a sea of arms. Everybody was extending a salute to Hitler, except him. Now, he wasn't always a dissident. 2 years before, he had identified as a party as with the Nazi Party, and he went along with everything. And then he met a woman named Irma Eckler, and the drawback was she was Jewish. And they went to get married, and they revoked his membership in the Nazi Party, and they denied his marriage certificate. 1935, they had a child. By 1936, when this photo was taken, he's now 26 years old, and he refused to salute. Well, he tried to leave Germany in 1937, and he was detained for dishonoring the race. And he was told to stop seeing her. He refused. They were both arrested. She was sent to prison where she had her second child, and they never saw each other again, and she died in 1942. And he was sent to a concentration camp, then he was drafted, and he was declared missing in action. Well, not conforming can have consequences. Being faithful to God, that can be a real challenge sometimes. It can come at a steep cost, and there may be those dark periods in our lives. This is what we see in the life of Esther and Mordecai. It looks like things are going to turn out very badly. They have plans to exterminate a whole race of people in their society. And next week, we'll see that this problem just doesn't go away. But where was God? Why was He silent? There's one thing that we should strive to do whenever we're going through a period of silence and we're praying about something or something's not resolving and we're trying and God seems to be silent. We need to understand that there is a purpose for that silence. Pastor Andrew Brunson faced silence. There was no change in his circumstance. But all across the world, you might remember hearing about him in the news, word got out about what he had been facing. And after 2 years of being wrongfully imprisoned in 2018, this is what he said. Let me be clear. I'm not in prison for anything I've done wrong, but because of who I am, a Christian pastor, I believe this is true. It is an honor to suffer for Jesus Christ as many have before me. So Christians, sometimes we have to stand alone. Just like Esther and Mordecai. And we have to know that God will not be silent forever. We may stand alone in the classroom. We may stand alone in the office. We may stand alone in our families. Sometimes you may be the only Christian in your family. God may seem to be silent, but He's with you. And you'll have your opportunity to speak up. When God is silent, you may feel uncertain. But remember, He's never left you alone. Keep praying. Keep trusting God. Keep being faithful. Trust God to act. Trust God to work. The fact is, even though He seems silent, He's always at work. And next week, we'll see that God will reveal this plot to the right person. What I've learned in my life, and that's what I shared with you today, my testimony, my little testimony, is that when God is silent, we have to trust Him more. We have to trust Him more to be with us. We have to trust Him to help us. That if we draw near to God, He will draw near to us. Sometimes we just have to trust Him that He has His reasons for being silent and know that He's going to work all things out for good, for those that love Him and that obey Him. I'm going to be singing an old gospel hymn. It says, what a friend we have in Jesus. Jesus is the friend you can always trust on. You can always trust Him. He'll always be with you. He'll always help you, even if He's silent sometimes. Let's stand as we sing.